You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Let us send a message to women everywhere that in this Parliament, their voices will be heard and their rights upheld.
Yeah. Here in the UK, opposition MP Stella Creasy forces a major concession on abortion rights for women from Northern Ireland as Theresa May attempts to assemble a majority. What does this tell us about how Brexit negotiations are going to go? My guests, Sebastian Borger and Alessio Patilano, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel's apparent conversion to the cause of same-sex marriage, principled epiphany or political expedience, Italy's threat to close its ports to migrant rescue boats, will it persuade other European countries to lend a hand, and would Italy really do it if it didn't, and
when a Russian naval task force appeared to our north at the time of the Brisbane G20, I was told that neither of our two deployed submarines could shadow it. They simply couldn't get there in time.
Australia's attempt to get to grips with its shortage of submarines and with the possibility that Tony Abbott might have a point. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and Alessio Patilano, lecturer in war studies at King's College London. Welcome both. We will start here in London, where within the last hour, MPs have voted aye on the Queen's speech in practical terms, deciding that Prime Minister Theresa May is able to command the Commons majority, which will enable her to form a government. One major concession has been forced. The NHS in England will provide abortions free to women from Northern Ireland, where abortion laws are much stricter, and whose Democratic Unionist Party, of course, will now hold the balance of power. Sebastian, first of all, the government caved on this amendment from the Labour MP Stella Creasy. Tory ministers were worried that rebel Tory MPs would vote in favour of it. What does that tell us about the future of this government?
Well, first of all, I think it's a welcome decision. Obviously, it's an absolute outrage that for me as a taxpayer in this country, that in England, that I mean the English NHS and the Scottish NHS will now pay for abortions of women in Northern Ireland, while at the same time we English and Scottish taxpayers, blow the money left, right, and centre all the time. But that's by the by. I never had any doubt that this government would get going. I don't. To be honest, I'm not entirely sure whether I share all that excitement. By the way, of course, the government was built by the Queen asking Theresa May to form a government. What happened today was has it got the confidence of the Commons? And of course, it has the confidence of the Commons. I still don't understand why a party with 317 seats in the House out of 650 needed to bribe the Democratic Unionists with 10 seats by a measure of 1 billion for 2 years. Because, they should have just said, look, this is our program. We are obviously talking to you. And we are they took out all the controversial measures anyway. We're talking to you, and we'd like you to support us. And if you don't support us, what will happen? The left of very left
will become Prime Minister, who is about the DUP's least favourite
exactly.
British politician.
There we are.
I do wonder. I'll put this to you, Alessio. You are both, of course, from continental Europe, where coalition building is the rule rather than the exception. Do you just get the impression that the British aren't used to it, and therefore don't really know how to do it?
It's a very good question. I think you're right, in the sense that I remember when the Lib Dem and the Conservatives got together, if you want, as a foreigner that is quite accustomed to continental politics, and, you know, dare I say, Italy being one of these sort of shining beacon of,
careful,
you know,
coalition government,
of getting together and eventually find the majority somewhere, somehow, right? I was kind of like shocked how long did it take and how big of a deal they made out of it. So I think there is a lack of habit, if you want, in doing this, but also because the political system is designed in a way to have a clear-cut solutions. Now, what has happened more recently is that this is not always the case, so you have to sort of negotiate. Now, I totally agree with you. I mean, the question is, like, did they have to make such big of a fuss out of this? I don't think so, because you can negotiate point by point on specific issues, but a minority government, you know, the life of a minority government is in danger regardless of how strong of an alliance they sign up today with whichever party.
Indeed.
And in a way, Jeremy Corbyn's sniffing that he has an option somewhere, naturally, if you want, to create the conditions for the minority government to just take a step back. It's like, you know what, guys, if you really don't support us, look who's coming next. You know,
well,
and can I just also say, I mean, none of these parties, including Labour, I would argue, wants another election.
Totally.
Nobody
wants another election because literally nobody has any idea what would happen at another election. Almost literally anything could. Ian Paisley Jr. could be Prime Minister.
Well, that would be something. Well, actually, seriously,
that would be unlikely.
I mean, all the Labour guys, particularly on the left, are saying one more heave and we'll be in down. I don't think so.
But Sebastian, there was a curious, well, interesting subplot as well today, which is that another Labour MP, Chuka Rumunna, did table an amendment which would have expressed a measure of enthusiasm for the single market, customs union, reciprocal rights for EU citizens, etc. Jeremy Corbyn whipped Labour to abstain. Something strangely he didn't mention he was going to do at Glastonbury. I can't think why. At least 51 Labour MPs appear to have rebelled. What does that tell us?
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. Labour is split down the middle, or in fact, I mean, it's three quarters.
I would say
pro-European, whereas Corbyn is a committed Eurosceptic bordering on Europhobe. I mean, he voted against every European integration measure. Not least, he voted against membership in 1975, and we're not quite sure what he did last year. But this is going to be a running sore in that party, as it is going to be in the Conservatives, of course. And so, you know, they've very skillfully avoided to commit in the election campaign, and people were taken by all sorts of other nice promises. But if they were put on the spot, I mean, Labour would be in at least as much chaos as the Tories.
Alessio, are we learning anything here about how the next couple of years might unfold if more pro-Remain MPs on both sides of the aisle, and we should not forget that there is a significant cohort of Conservative members of Parliament who are pro-Remain, if they start to sense a genuine shift in public mood, quite, you know, if you got consistent polls starting to run towards, I don't know, 60-40, saying we're not all that keen on this after all?
That's a possibility. I think it depends very much. So the answer to your question depends on whether you can see that such a shift would actually then bring about a change of mood in political terms to a point that you would abandon the idea altogether. I don't think that is going to happen. I think it's very unlikely as things are looking. Because if that mood has not been created right now, in a very strong sense, it's unlikely to come up in the foreseeable future, because it has been really chaotic. I mean, the last few months, even the triggering of Article 50, what happened afterwards, the election for the snap elections.
I know, it's almost like nobody thought this through.
No, from beginning up until now, and there seems to be no plan emerging. I mean, the Prime Minister going there and presenting finally, it's like, I've got all figured out in terms of reciprocity of rights of British citizens in the EU and foreign European nationals in the UK. And everybody was like, really? Seriously? And it took you like a year to come up with this?
And we found loopholes within half an hour.
I mean, that's exactly.
So it really is very worrying.
And that is incredibly worrying. So I think if people had not been sort of organised just as yet, it means that I doubt you'll have that sort of drive that'll come at some point down the road. And I think part of the problem is very simple. And here we're going back to the point that Sebastian was making about Jeremy Corbyn. Labour if really had a Saul that was sitting in the Remain side would probably talk about the importance of the EU, not just in terms of economic benefits, but in terms of the ideals and the ideas that it has for Europe and Europeans. And that's never happened under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership.
Fascinating, because he talks idealism and ideas all the time, but not on Europe.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, let's move along now, because as well as the country in which we all live, the countries in which we're each from are all going to get a run on today's episode. It's quite exciting. It's like Eurovision. We go to Sebastian's native Germany next, which may vote to legalise same-sex marriage as soon as tomorrow, surprising both those who do closely follow German politics and are therefore aware of Chancellor Angela Merkel's long-standing reservations, and those who don't closely follow German politics, who probably assumed that Germany had already done this years ago. Sebastian, Germany did, in fact, legalise same-sex partnerships in 2001 under the SPD Greens government. Has the hold-up since, has this just been the Christian Democratic Union not quite being ready for this? Is that basically it?
I think it reflects wider German society. I think it needed time to settle in that 2001 law, and it needed time for society's perceptions and attitudes to move on. I haven't looked at the latest opinion polls, but I think it is now a clear majority for gay or indeed equal marriage.
One of the members of that society whose opinions have moved on is, of course, the Chancellor Angela Merkel. Are you buying it, Sebastian? Has she had a genuine epiphany here, or does she realise there's an election coming up? I may need the SDU on board to form another coalition.
Does it matter?
Does it matter
what I believe? And also, does it matter whether it's genuine or not? What she did is extremely skillful politics. She realizes there is a coalition of parties, the liberals, the former communists, the social democrats, and the Greens, aligned against me. Now, what do I do? I come out and I say it. At a woman magazine's conference, I say, well, maybe it should be a matter of conscience, and so therefore I basically put all my responsibility as a party leader off a party which is still, I would have thought, by a large majority anti-gay marriage. I just put my responsibility to one side and say, well, look, you guys go ahead.
You decide it's a conscience vote. Alessio, where is Italy on this? Italy got around to approving same-sex civil unions last year, the last country in Western Europe to do that. Obviously, there's cultural reasons for that. There's the influence of the Catholic Church, etc., but is Italy proceeding in the same direction as the rest of Western Europe? Is marriage equality in Italy inevitable?
Yes, the question is the timing. And never forget that the Vatican is in Rome. If geography matters at all in life.
They're tricky to ignore.
Ignore in all sorts of ways. As a friend of mine many years ago quite correctly pointed out, the first time you visit Rome, you understand why Italians are Catholics by default. And then they learn throughout their lifetime whether they are not or they are indeed Catholic. And I think there's a point there, as in there is a connection. There is a strong Italian sort of politics, particularly sort of Rome politics, are really very much influenced by the presence of the Church and the Vatican there. So I think there's a lot of slow motion movement, but I don't think that if you ask that question to the average person on the street and you do some sort of a survey, I don't think there is any sort of preconceived ideas that should not happen. Again, the timing is going to be central in terms of negotiating with the various different components, most notably sort of the more traditional conservative Catholic elements, how to get to that point. And I think in this respect, the Church itself is making some quite important sort of step forward. Pope it's been very much in that sort of the poop has been very much in that sort of direction. So I think really it's a question of time rather than whether or not it's going to happen.
Sebastian, in Germany, what's your sense of the dynamic here? Is this a generational thing? Is it just the case that people who are in their teens now are just going to grow up being absolutely baffled that this was ever an issue?
Partly that, partly it's regional, because the Catholic regions are still, by a majority against it, whereas large swathes of northern Protestant Germany and the basically churchless East couldn't care less. I mean, and but it's also generational, I think, yes.
You think that's the case in Italy as well?
Totally. Yes. No. Absolutely. No. I think the generational element is absolutely important, and we've seen this across all sorts of manifestation of controversial political issues over the past couple of years across Europe. If you go to France, if you go to this country, you know, when it comes to thorny issues, clearly there is a generational divide. Whether it is Brexit, whether it is the life of the EU, where you want to go, whether it is gay marriage. Generally speaking, there is a clear sense that all these complex issues have a very different take whether you are a millennial or not.
I mean, this is where I should, of course, say don't even start me on Australia, whose failure to get with the program on this just continues to boggle my mind. You just think, really, how possibly difficult can this be? But Sebastian, looking, I guess, finally at Germany, it's always interesting when a progressive, inclusive, if you will, reform like this is enacted. There will be people in Germany who don't like it, who will disagree with it. Will they actually make a thing of it, though? Are there people who are going to be angry enough about it to campaign against it to try and make this process difficult?
Well, there, first of all, there are the conservatives in Bavaria, my native Bavaria, who will definitely vote against it, and also, of course, the law which the Bundestag may enact tomorrow will have to pass through the upper house of the Länder. I can't quite figure out what the majority will be there, but it's gesture politics for the time being, and then, of course, there's always you will always find someone going to our constitutional court to challenge it.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Sebastian Borger and Alessio Patalano. Coming up next, Italy threatens to close its ports to some migrants.
Monocle has bureau around the world in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
There's something about Tokyo. Once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting. It's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. Most months, actually most weeks, there's something new to keep us interested. You know, either it's a new development or a really interesting new building, a new fashion brand, something going on.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Sebastian Borger and Alessio Patalano. And we turn now to Alessio's homeland of Italy, which by accident of geography was always going to find itself on the front line of any large-scale migration from North Africa. And this has indeed been the case these last few years. Already in 2017, more than 73,000 boat-borne arrivals have landed in Italy. And these are, of course, the fortunate ones who've made it across the Mediterranean. This is an increase of 14% year on year, and there is no end in sight. Italy has now threatened to close its ports to foreign flagged ships bringing migrants until or unless the rest of the EU starts pulling its weight. Alessio, how in Italy itself, how big a crisis is this now seen as being? It's been going on now for a few years, of course.
It has, and I think there is an element, so there's two components to it. One is the sustainability, and that we're long past that component. I mean, it's not is not no longer sustainable for Italy to actually keep receiving migrants, just because there aren't places where you can sort of allow them to sort of spend some time. Most of the centres that were set up, they're overly crowded, and they're becoming really difficult to maintain and sustain. And then there is the political and psychological component to it, as in the Italian governments over the past few years have seen as failing in delivering to the Italian people a solution that would be seen, perceived, and indeed sort of concretely felt as European, because it's not just an Italian problem. And Europe cannot just sort of turn its head around and say, like, well, you know, it's not really a problem because the Italians eventually will find a space where to put these people. That's not the question anymore. We're long past that. So I think there's two elements, the specific sort of mechanical element to it. How do you welcome these people in the country? And we're well past the sort of the levels of the possibility to, for Italy to handle all these migrants. And then there is the social and political one. And it is seen, I mean, even the Democratic Party, which has been particularly sort of lenient and welcoming and trying to find a solution that would allow for more migrants to be taken. And it's been very engaging at the European level to find a solution that would be acceptable to most Europeans. Even they are now struggling to find some sort of a political narrative that would allow them to be, you know, like doing their job legitimately to the eyes of the Italian population.
Sebastian, do you see an echo here of the German experience, which of course was initially one of extraordinary generosity and openness, and then it rapidly became clear that both in practical and political terms there was going to have to be a limit to that?
Absolutely. I mean, Berlin will follow developments with eagle eyes. You can imagine 3 months out from a federal election, the only issue that can cost Angela Merkel this election and her fourth term would be another another migrant run like we've seen in 2015. She will put presumably a lot of pressure on some of our European allies to pull their weight, and she will, I guess, have sympathy with the Italian government, saying it can't go on like that. I mean, I think I understand that there's a package already there that you know, more support for Libya, so people will stay there. But we've got to get tougher. We as Europe, and presumably with European navies as well, with the people traffickers who are behind this. Let's not forget that the main, it's not, you know, we're talking about 2 years ago we talked mainly, at least to start with, about people from a terribly war-torn country, namely Syria. These days we're talking mainly about Nigerians and Bangladeshis. Now, you know, whatever happens in Nigeria and Bangladesh, it's not pleasant, presumably, for a lot of people to live there, but it's not as if they are fleeing civil war.
Alessio, do you get the sense that across Europe in general, we've seen some Eastern European countries, for fairly obviously, transparently populist/xenophobic reasons, just deciding that, you know, these people aren't our problem and they can't come here, notably Hungary and Poland. But yeah. Is there going to start becoming an argument made by other European countries that maybe that's the only practical way forward? That, and this is, I understand that the Australian experience is different for all sorts of reasons, but this was the line that Australia eventually took, just saying, like, you can't come. You know, there will be no path to settlement here.
So there's two. So this question has to be broken down into two different components. One, that is, how do you prevent them from taking the seat in the first place? And that will require a number of very serious political discussions as to whether one acts upon in Libya with the local government and working with the authorities there to address the smugglers, to address the fact that you have camps there that sort of centres that take people and sort of help them sort of settling down. And you start sort of engaging more broadly with the African continent, because the migration is pretty much across all over sort of Africa and the Middle East. And Libya is just is the departing point. This is just the platform, the launching pad. You know, have you ever asked the question why the closest way to get into Europe is not through Libya? actually. He's from Morocco, through the Canary Islands, into Spain. How many Maghrebins are coming through there? Not that many. The eastern side...
Because it works as a state, basically.
Exactly right. So at the moment, what has happened is that the only country that has difficulties in this sense, it's Italy, and mostly because from Libyan shores, Italy is the closest point, and there is an unwillingness politically to engage with that. So I think the problem is at one level political. Then once they take sort of life at sea and they cross, then of course the question is that Italy has all the legal rights to shut down ports if they want to. There's nothing to say against that. But then again, in that context, there's this discussion over whether the Europeans should change their approach and either shut down or redistribute.
Well, finally tonight, my own homeland of Australia gets a look in. Tony Abbott, who was Prime Minister for a bit before people noticed that Tony Abbott was Prime Minister, has been continuing his ill-disguised campaign to undermine his successor by complaining that Australia is suffering from a critical submarine gap. He notes, for example, that when a Russian fleet loomed off Brisbane in 2014, Australia did not have a submarine available to shadow it. Australia's submarine fleet comprises six Collins-class boats, of which at any given moment two are in maintenance, two are being used for training, leaving just two to do submarine stuff. Alessio, bring your naval expertise to bear on this. Australia has 26,000 kilometres of coastline. Is two submarines a bit meagre for that?
It is, but in the sense, you know, everything is relative. It's just a matter of strategy. What the submarines are supposed to do? And so saying like, well, there's a couple of Russian ships, showing up one day and we cannot sort of shout at them.
I mean, we weren't going to torpedo them.
That
would have seemed an overreaction.
Well, I think it was a little bit. No, he was trying to make
Couldn't
a point.
You ask New Zealand for help, mate.
No, I think it depends because there are.
You'd be more likely to side with the Russians, to be honest.
I think what I've always thought was a bit of a stranger discussion was the mismatch between the technical discussion over what kind of submarines Australia should build and have, and the strategic rationale for it. Because you can have conventional distance and range, which is the implicit point that he was making about these submarines, is not necessarily a problem if your strategy is a strategy of employing submarines for blockading, transit passage type of places, where a diesel submarine is absolutely perfectly fine. That's what the German and Italians U212 does. That's what part of the Japanese do. And it worked perfectly because that's part of their strategy. The question is that in Australian maritime strategy, dare I say, it's always unclear what these subs are supposed to be doing. Sort of putting it as a question of like, well, the Japanese did not have the legs to do the stuff. The French version does not exist and we don't know when it will exist, fair point. And the Germans are too small. You know, it's a bit of a reduction, sort of simplistic way of looking at that debate. You need to place into a strategy and then you can start off with these considerations.
How many surface vessels are there? I mean, presumably there are a few as well.
We do have some. The Australian Navy, or the Royal Australian Navy, I should say, is not huge, but the Australian military has that weird thing whereby it is a defence force, but our island really has no natural predators. It doesn't necessarily have to think in terms strictly of national defence.
Mm. I mean, what politically, what interests me is this guy Abbott talks about something which happened in 2014. I would have thought that was covered by the Official Secret Act or whatever the equivalent is.
Well, I mean, I think we knew the Russians were there. Yes. That was the point of them being there,
Secondly, if you have a G20 meeting, wouldn't you maybe plan for some...
Somebody should have a word with the guy who was Prime Minister at the time.
Indeed, and maybe have one or two submarines out there in the waters of Brisbane. I think he's shot himself in the foot.
Alessio, Tony Abbott's big idea, because Australia does have 12 new submarines that we're of a French design that we're supposed to be building, but they won't enter service until the 2030s if we're lucky. He wants to buy nuclear-powered submarines now. As far as I understand it, we don't actually have any nuclear-powered ships in Australia, nor the capacity to operate them. Is this worth doing?
Well, I think if you ask...
It's not going to be cheap, is it?
No, it's not going to be cheap. But at the same time, whenever the French design was selected, I always thought that would be the easier version, not the diesel one. Because the French stopped making diesel submarines larger than 3,000 tons the moment they realised they weren't capable of having diesel engines engines that would operate. That's why they went nuclear for that. And that's why their nuclear subs, even though they're very small, they're actually nuclear. So I always thought that eventually down the line, someone would have sort of turned around in Australia and say like, hey, actually, this thing, we're not sure is going to go well. Let's go nuclear.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Sebastian Borger and Alessio Patilano, thank you both very much for joining us. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hansa Chakalan. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next at 1900. Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist. I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening.